Well, if you want to know what Eisenhower thought, I suppose we can just ask Eisenhower. That and some listener questions on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. Okay, Lena Meyer from Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina writes, "Hey, Bruce, I have been listening to the podcast for some time, and I am even more dependent on it since taking a political science class to gain an unbiased perspective on the political issues of the day. I have a question that kind of branched off the August 19th podcast titled Partisanship and Ugly Politics. Is there any truth that the conservative movement has radicalized itself away from the great conservative thinkers such as Edmund Burke, William F. Buckley, Whitaker Chambers, that Sam Tenenhouse spoke about in his interview? I got into a bit of a tussle with my conservative political science teacher when I brought this topic up in class, and would really like to know what your great historical perspective has to say about this. Thanks." Well, first of all, it was news to me, so I had to read the transcript of the interview with Bill Myers, and I read a little bit about Tenenhouse. He is the biographer of William F. Buckley and an editor of the book review section of the New York Times. In his thinking, there are now two camps of conservatives, realist conservatives and revanchist conservatives. Realist conservatives are those who see a certain amount they would like to change, but realize that most things have to stay. You know, it's not there's not going to be a great conservative revolution. We have certain social programs already in the United States. Whereas the revanchists want everything back, and they're willing to do what it takes to bring everything back to a conservative utopia, so to speak. I may be, you know, I'm paraphrasing him, but that's sort of what his book is asserting. First, a little background on the three people mentioned. William F. Buckley, Jr., probably liberals' favorite conservative in a way, having run for mayor of New York against John Lindsay and had a popular TV show for some time where he interviewed guests, a thoughtful conservative, you know, founder of the National Review, a supporter of both Reagan and Barry Goldwater. Originally against civil rights, Buckley changed in the late 60s in time to oppose George Wallace and support a Martin Luther King holiday. Edmund Burke is among those of whom I call the secret American army, fighting for us in the revolution, but not fighting in America, fighting in the House of Commons. They're a long-forgotten group, but very important to the American revolutionary cause. Without them, we never would have won, or we would have been in perpetual battle. He was a British Whig in Parliament, and the Whigs were supporters of America, Edmund Burke among them. Burke felt that we were being treated harshly with the taxes that Britain was imposing on us. He also supported free trade, lower taxes, natural prices, no manipulation of prices by government. He stood up for Catholics and Indians, and he opposed the French Revolution even while he supported the American one. Because the American Revolution, he felt, was an individualistic revolution, whereas the French Revolution was fighting for an abstract rights of man, which he was not sure that he agreed with. Whitaker Chambers was a former Soviet spy in the Roosevelt administration, who, after the Stalin purges in 1936, when Stalin, you know, sent people to the Gulag, including members of his army even, Whitaker Chambers flipped, and proving there's no zealot like a convert, he flipped hard on the communists, and he outed Alger Hiss, and he joined Buckley on the National Review. These are three conservative icons. They represent the best of conservatism. I would go only this far. They are different from Republicans in today in methods and perhaps tone. You know, Republicans in Congress and the House, those folks showing up at town hall meetings with signs and screaming and yelling, opposing all the actions of the Obama administration. Republicans in the 1940s and still in the 1950s were the minority party, even when Eisenhower was president. They had one shot at Congress for 2 years, and then They were SmackDown hard. They also lost the 1948 presidential election race, which was disheartening for the party. They felt they had a great candidate in the governor of New York, Thomas Dewey. And the Democrats had a weak candidate in Harry S. Truman. And the 1948 election seemed to confirm that it was inevitable. The Democrats would always win and Republicans would be the minority party. So they probably were, back then, at the time that the National Review was starting, a little realist. Not a party that was interested in challenging the basic assumptions of the New Deal. If they wanted to get into power ever, they had to sort of go along to get along. Now, at that time, they were realistic. 40 years later, with a better situation, they would be fine with dismantling. Buckley, for instance, supported Reagan. And while Reagan was careful not to touch the electric fence of Social Security, that was about it. Reagan was looking to retrench the New Deal and to lower the size of the government, except where military spending was concerned, where the government would be increased. So I would differ a bit from, as I see his argument, but in tactics and tones, certainly the current Republicans are setting themselves up for the 2010 elections. We've said it so many times on this program. We watched it happen before the 2006 midterms occurred. Party out of power and the first term of a president usually gains seat. There's no guarantee, however, that party gains the House, especially where Democrats have a significant margin. Now, that's what I believe Republicans are battling internally and sort of developing a strategy to go for. And there's various groups within the Republican Party. Some would rather go along a little bit more, and others want to fight. They'd like to take the House back, thank you very much, and not just gain a few seats. So what I believe you're seeing with President Obama, at least initially an extremely popular president with a huge majority in Congress looking to change things. You're seeing what you might say in football is a big D, a big defense. Everything that comes out of the Obama administration is going to be opposed. And they're utilizing grassroots, they're utilizing email, utilizing certain friendly media sources, Fox News, the Rush Limbaughs, the Glenn Becks, these type of people. They're doing everything. They're throwing everything at this new president. If Obama is the most popular, if he is darted out to some extent as popular as Reagan did in 1981, I will say this already. The Republicans have done a much better job in 2009 from a political perspective, in opposing everything that's coming out of that White House than Democrats could do in 1981. Reagan took the Democrats by surprise. So many of the Democratic congressional members were sympathetic to Reagan's views anyway. They were the Beau Weevil Democrats, different from Blue Dogs today. They weren't even moderate. Some of them were extremely conservative. And their main problem was that their voters were backing Reagan. So Democrats were not able to utilize some of the tactics, and some of these technologies were not even available. So you've already seen a much better job. You know, coming up with little points of disagreement and always finding what's proposed the most sinister argument that will get the most people upset, the sort of the death panels. And so it's all about 2010. Historically, opposition parties should gain in the midterms. Republicans would like to do that. They also realize that if a president is successful in getting legislation through the Congress, it's one of the things voters look at. It's one of the things independents like, a strong president who can get things through Congress. That's a plus for the president and his party, and that will halt their gains. They don't want that. Republicans seem to have a good idea of the history and their strategy. They know that they need to develop roadblocks along the way. The trouble for the Republicans, which may be sort of inherent in your question and in your discussion with the professor, is that if they are perceived as too radical, in other words, if the core Republican group and the Republicans in Congress become too easily associated with, say, the birthers and the death panel type people, if they're always seen as using the most extreme argument, I think they have this problem. In President Obama, while his approval rating goes up and down, you know, as weeks go on here, you have a person who's been able to represent the comm center more than anybody in recent memory in Washington. It is very dangerous for Republicans to be seen as too far out, you know, and they want to use the type of arguments that will get people emotional, especially their base. 2010 is going to be a base election. But if they go too far, the independent voters are going to see that and react. On that note, I haven't had a chance to talk about it today, but certainly I would express some disappointment with what occurred during the president's speech on health care, where Representative Joe Wilson got up and shouted, "You lie," during the president's speech. I mean, it's certainly that's a pretty bad event. Doesn't look good for political independence. That's the kind of direction that if they continue down, it's going to be bad. Now, immediately, as occurs with any partisan activity, both sides are kind of crystallizing with their positions. But on one hand, they're going to say, well, Democrats are using this to raise money for the opponent, which they certainly have done. And then Joe Wilson kind of goes back home and gets some, you know, pats on the back and things like that. And it's always, the one thing in history is it's always very difficult to punish members of Congress. This almost always happens. It's, you know, somebody does something bad and, you know, their party will vote for him, the other party votes against him, and you're back to the same partisan squabbles. But on top of all of that, I think we have to admit, as Joe Wilson at least admitted initially, that it's just bad form to be doing that during a speech. And a few more of those type of incidents, and that's not going to, that'll look bad for the larger party, whether they realize it or not. So it's very difficult to compare the three conservative icons to Republicans or conservatives of today. Different situation for Republicans. The one clue that you have is you take a fellow like William F. Buckley, supported Reagan, you know, Whitaker Chambers, who would end up getting an award by Reagan. These were Reaganites. Reagan would end up doing as much as he could to reverse the New Deal. He wasn't just a realist. He really did want to change. Certainly on the foreign policy side, he completely changed how he did foreign policy, both in advocating strong military spending and in changing the relationship with the Soviet Union. So he wasn't somebody to sort of listen to what rules were prescribed and exist in somebody else's political sphere. Nixon was a little bit more of that, a little bit more, especially on the domestic side. So Reagan, not a realist, and Buckley supported Reagan. So I may differ a little bit from Mr. Tannenhaus that there is this major change. I wish you luck with your political science studies. I think it's enjoyable. And you can learn a lot from somebody who's politically opposed to you. Just, you know, keep your head up, keep researching things. There's many, many different points of view. And when we have an ideology, what does it really mean? This is one of the things I was trying to get at the partisan podcast. What does it really mean in ideology? I think to some extent it means you've decided on things you won't listen to, right? Because we can only focus on so many things. So much of politics, just like marketing or anything else, comes down to what you're going to choose to focus on. Anytime you're in a class with somebody else, you can listen to points of view or hear an issue or say, what about this? You know, I think it helps. I thought I would touch on something I brought up a few weeks ago, but that I just didn't get the sense I nailed. I'm not sure I hit the note, you know. The question was asked about Eisenhower and the military-industrial complex, and it's kind of a shocking statement he made in the end of his farewell address. And I think some of the mysteriousness around the term can be eliminated, and I'd like to do that and just kind of explain what Eisenhower was saying. But to truly determine what Ike was talking about, one person we can ask is Eisenhower himself, what he meant when he used that term. I've looked at his 1965 memoir, which was in two parts. This is the second part about the second term, Waging Peace. He said that his speech was mostly intended to be pleasantries and just saying farewell to the nation, but he wished to have at least a challenging message. When we hear the term military-industrial complex, it sounds like a sinister bunch of people that are going to take over the country, bring us to perpetual war. Eisenhower admits, first of all, in his memoir, that he is partially responsible. He directed the first U.S. peacetime military buildup. After Korea, Eisenhower says, I wanted to be sure that we were never so weak as to provoke attack. He knew even at the time that he took office, that we had to move from the system we had of where, when the nation went to war, the companies would start beating plowshares into swords. So companies like Ford and General Motors would start making armaments. And he knew if he moved from just having the normal company switch to war operations when they needed to having a permanent group of companies that would produce these armaments, that there would be a side effect. Companies would need constant business. They'd like more profit. They would lobby the Pentagon. The Pentagon, getting in equipment, being the managers of the overseas of equipment, kind of helped them secure their jobs. The Pentagon would lobby Congress. Eisenhower also talked about how, being a general and seeing other generals, he always felt that officers wanted more equipment than what was probably needed. So the companies would lobby the Pentagon and Congress. The Pentagon would also lobby Congress, and Congress would lobby the administration. Everybody seeking for more industrial buildup, for more military spending. But Eisenhower says, unjustified military spending is a waste of national resources. And as a free society, we should be directing that. This, to me, is the talk of an old general who had seen profiteers come and go and wanted to set apart in his speech, a speech that traditionally George Washington did it, can be used for a message of challenge to the nation and to this topic. I don't think it was an extremely dark vision about America and, or the world coming to end or anything like that. It was mostly, I think, probably, reading what he said about it, the term could have been changed to military-industrial lobby. And it wouldn't seem so crazy a term now because he used the term military-industrial complex to reflect the complexity of it, that there were so many interlocking pieces that it was hard to fight. It sounds a little worse than it is, or than it was. But make no mistake, and we'll look at some other things that Eisenhower said in his memoir, Eisenhower was a supporter of military spending, and it basically created the peacetime military. Since we're asking Eisenhower about that, I figure we might as well look at a few other questions we could ask. One would be, to what extent did he foresee Vietnam? Well, Eisenhower says very little about Vietnam. He was writing this in 64, published in 65. It's probably a tad early. What he talks about extensively in his memoirs, Laos, a farming kingdom near Vietnam, about the size of Pennsylvania. China and North Vietnam were interfering there, trying to take over the government. And the current government there was somewhat sympathetic to the communists. So he went as far as to encourage the changing of the government and sending naval ships nearby with troops ready to land if necessary, and instructing the ambassador to the Soviet Union to tell Khrushchev that this was an area of great concern for the U.S. This happened, a lot of this happened towards 1960, towards the end of his administration, or 1960-61, towards the end of his administration. So he indicates that while he regretted passing on a cloudy and serious situation to the next president, he said the policy he handed down in verse the situation was sound. He instructed his generals that they must hold Laos from communist domination, and if necessary, we must fight. He gave the same message to John F. Kennedy when the two met before Kennedy was inaugurated. When the two met before Kennedy was inaugurated. In his memoir, written before Vietnam got very ugly, he warned that if Laos fell, Cambodia and South Vietnam might fall as well, too, like dominoes. Eisenhower was not responsible for the military buildup in Vietnam directly. There were just a few American advisors sent there during his presidency, and his focus, as we said, was mostly on Laos. But there were two ideological contributions that he made that one could look at very strongly with the history of what happened next. He set down the gauntlet that this was an important area, Southeast Asia, and we must prevent communist infiltration or fight. That had political ramifications. So Democrats were looking at a popular general and what he was saying too. And, you know, nobody wanted to be seen as weak in this area. He also indicated to President Kennedy during his visit that doing this through CETO, which is a which was a group that included the French and various southeastern nations, Southeast Asian nations, was going to be ineffective. It was going to have to be Americans that were going to take the lead there. So the old general was had an indirect role. We might also ask Eisenhower about why he ran for president in the first place. A successful general had accomplished much. A successful general had accomplished much, liked by all. Why do you want to enter politics? But before we look at what Ike thought, I'll state that the United States has a, though it's a civilian government, is not unlike many places in the world in that we have had popular generals become our nation's leader, starting with George Washington, Andrew Jackson, William Henry Harrison, Ulysses S. Grant. We could include Benjamin Harrison, perhaps. Ike, like Grant, was coveted by both parties, and he was not clearly in either camp. But in his memoirs, he cites that Alexis de Tocqueville said that it was advisable for the country to change parties every once in a while. He agreed with that. Democrats were in power 20 years, the time of the 1952 election. Eisenhower felt it was important to preserve our two-party system. But he wasn't completely nonpartisan either. He felt that the Democrats represented a collective power philosophy. And for a philosophy of the individual to have any continuance in American life, it was necessary for Republicans to win that election. Advocated the bedrock, you know, principles of conservatives and Republicans. Wasn't a strong partisan. He did regret not expanding the Republican Party. Eisenhower was never able to do that. Nixon lost in 1960, and Democrats held the House for the most part during their during his term. He also wrote about his vice president, Nixon, and the question of did he want to dump Nixon in 1956. He states clearly that he had never intended to do so at all. The thought had never crossed his mind. He did advise Richard Nixon that if he was going to run for president, you got to remember at this time, is that only Martin Van Buren had gone from a sitting vice president to the presidency. So Eisenhower said to Nixon, if you're going to run for president, you ought to get to one of the cabinet spots and build your a constituency there, maybe become defense secretary or something like that. Now, whether he was doing that to sort of get rid of Nixon, you know, we'll never know. But in his memoir, that was the way that he proposed it. He expressed surprise when he read Richard Nixon's memoir, The Six Crises, in which Nixon indicated that he was very anxious, wondering whether Eisenhower would dump him or not. Thought never crossed his mind, Eisenhower said so. That concludes our interview with Eisenhower. Had an interesting time reading that memoir. Okay, so Dan Michener writes, I wondered if you could talk about the use of the term czar for someone that the president appoints and the use of czars in history. Czar. So Obama has many czars, and this has led many to in Congress, Democrats like Russ Feingold, Harry Byrd, Republican Susan Collins of Maine, to call for an investigation of this. Who are these people that Obama's putting in charge of various aspects of the federal government? It's not an extremely old concept. The term is new, but the concept is not. The idea of having one person for a task is not new at all, a kind of president's right-hand man. With the growth of the size of the federal government, it's increased many-fold. You know, there's a need for somebody who might be able to cut across cabinet departments and handle many tasks for one purpose. So you have a financial czar, a drug czar, terrorism czar, and the like. Now there's going to be some issues with that because the cabinet is a little bit more under congressional oversight traditionally than executive departments. I think one great example of this is the, you know, in a time when the term czar wasn't used, Harry Hopkins and Franklin Roosevelt used Harry Hopkins for everything to run the CWA, then the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, to manage huge multi-million dollar relief funds. I mean, you know, Hopkins set up an office in Washington, D.C., you know, and immediately just started handing out checks to various states and localities and getting aid to people. He was a one-man show in charge of that, and there was a lot of congressional criticism of the amount of power that Harry Hopkins had, but he was no doubt the president's right-hand man. He would also have a role in the Lend-Lease, helping out England and then in the war. But I thought an interesting example was that of General Hugh Johnson, who Roosevelt, early on in his presidency, put in charge of the NRA. And he did that because he felt, and the NRA was the national, not the National Rifle Association, of course, but the National Recovery Administration. And it was created by the National Recovery Act. And the idea of the National Recovery Administration was really a kind of a public-private partnership. But the intention was that the public part would be doing a lot of the directing, that they would get companies to work together to raise prices. Now, price deflation was a huge problem during the Great Depression. And if the companies could get together and promise not to compete for the lowest bid and also promise to pay better wages, that would help. Now, the problem is you had several antitrust laws on the books. So utilizing the National Recovery Administration, perhaps, with the federal government involved, they could get around that, because it wasn't just a meeting of these companies in a secret room. It was a meeting of these companies with the federal government, the National Recovery Administration. There would also be a Blue Eagle so that consumers would know which shops were following the rules and which weren't, and shop presumably from those who were helping the country get back on its feet again. It was a noble idea. It didn't really work. General Hugh Johnson was seen as the leader of this effort, and he had organized the draft during World War I under President Wilson, and done a great job with it, and quickly mobilized the country for war. So Roosevelt could think of no better person to put in than him. Kind of foreboding were the comments he made upon taking the job. "It'll be red fire at first and dead cats afterward," he remarked. "This is just like mounting the guillotine on the infinitesimal gamble that the axe won't work." So Johnson had a pretty good assessment of his chances. First, there was a little bit of the boom in the economy in 1933. There were Blue Eagle parades everywhere. 250,000 people marched down the street in New York City supporting the NRA. But by 1934, there were starting to be complaints about this one-man administration, the high prices that it was causing, all the government edicts on business. It really became the focus of opposition to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal because it seemed so government-directed. There was this Blue Eagle everywhere. Johnson was forced to agree to have the lawyer Clarence Darrow look at, investigate the practices of the NRA to see if it was helping big companies to hurt small companies, which Darrow would say it was. By September of 1934, Hugh Johnson was out, and a fellow named Donald Richburg, who was much more conservative, was put in. Although Hugh Johnson was called many names, czar was never one of them. The term czar comes, interestingly enough, from the same place the criticism is coming from now, from the Senate, where in 1982, the Senate voted overwhelmingly for the nation to create a drug czar to get the job done, to get a difficult task done that would require the cooperation of many agencies in fighting the scourge of drugs. Who's right in the squabble? To me, it points out a gray area in the separation of powers. When you have a system of separations of powers, power is shared, power doesn't go along. Well, that is really relying on the jealousies of men and sort of to create a fair system. It's a perfect working machine, you know. But it also creates problems down the line. Nothing's ever perfect. So this is our example. It is a perfect example. Cabinet members, for instance, are approved with the consent of the Senate. Czars are not necessarily so. A czar can be seen as just as an extension of the president's power, right hand. So while you can ask questions of a cabinet member, if you start to interfere too much with a czar, they might assert executive privilege and saying, "I'm essentially just an extension of President Obama, and you can't, you know, you can oversee, but I can claim privilege because I'm not quite in the same boat as you. I'm not, you're the legislative branch, I'm the presidential branch, essentially." The relationship between cabinets You know, who does the cabinet work for was a question in early America. Was a cabinet, were cabinet members independent people heading departments that Congress also, you know, that had two bosses, the president and a Congress, or were they responsible to the president? It gradually became true that the cabinet worked for the president. The president wanted to fire him. John Adams fired several of his members of his cabinet. The Tenure of Office Act after the Civil War, which led to the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, settled the question. Tenure of Office Act said that no one could be fired without the consent of the Congress. It was ruled unconstitutional. Too late for Andrew Johnson, but it was ruled unconstitutional. President appoints, Congress approves, and then the president fires or gets to resign cabinet members. I think there have always been czars, sort of, perhaps in the even within the cabinets, there are certain members of cabinets of any administration who are favored. You know, Hamilton in Washington's cabinet stands out, who not only completely, you know, created the American economy as we know it today in the banking system, but also weighed in on foreign policy. And in fact, his foreign policy prevailed with President Washington over the policy of Washington's own Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson. John Sherman under Rutherford B. Hayes, favored member of the cabinet. Hay under McKinley and Roosevelt, Secretary of State. William Gibbs McAdoo under Wilson, had a lot of power. Washington, D.C. then and now has a way of sniffing out power. So whether it's a cabinet secretary officially that has the president's ear or whether it's one of these czars, it's always going to depend on what Washington perceives that person's powers. Hugh Johnson, when he started, had Roosevelt's ear. Roosevelt started to tire of him by, you know, a year later, and then couldn't get anything done. Okay, and now on the group Acorn and Bills of Attainder, a surprising element of the Constitution which has come up recently. Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution limits Congress, and Article 1, Section 10 limits the states, prohibiting bills of attainder. Such bills are legislative punishments without benefit of a trial. So while the nation can make laws, Congress is empowered to make laws, they can't direct a law at one person and say, you're guilty. These punishments ignoring due process had been frequently abused in Great Britain, where Parliament had used them to punish ministers of the king often. In the Constitutional Convention, James Wilson of Pennsylvania claimed a number of states had adopted these type of laws and that we didn't want to see the new federal government have that power. But it was Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts and J. McHenry of Maryland who moved to add such a prohibition in the Constitutional Convention. The move was made on August 22nd. No bills of attainder and no ex post facto laws. And it was adopted 7-3. The Bill of Attainder was not one of the controversial points of the Constitutional Convention. Some scholars have noted that we have done it at times. We have there have been bills used against loyalists during the Revolutionary War. In the Civil War, there were some bills of attainder, banning rights to those who had been Confederates. There had been bills used against Mormons in Utah. And there were bills against communists in the 40s and 50s. Sometimes the U.S. Supreme Court has struck down these bills based on the Bill of Attainder Clause. So the group Acorn got into trouble for advising clients who turned out to be conservative activists dressed as a pimp and a prostitute, advising them how to get money from the federal government and to disguise their source of income. The video circulated on the internet, and Congress voted to restrict Acorn from receiving any federal money. So the group Acorn claims they fired the individuals involved. They claim most of their money comes from private donations and that they would perhaps fight this on a constitutional basis given the bills of attainder. So that has come up recently. Fred Cole writes, can I mention a few more podcasts to recommend? You mentioned the history of Rome, but I also want to mention Best of Today from the BBC, Between the Covers from NRO,
Derb Radio from NRO, The New Yorker Out Loud, and The New Yorker Political Science Podcast, Stuff You Missed in History Podcast, and Stuff You Should Know, both from HowStuffWorks.com. The Economist, they have editor's pick from the current issue in audio form. The Thomas Jefferson Hour, and of course, the amazing spycast from the International Spy Museum. Some of these are historical, several are political, some are designed to give me a rounded view of human life. I listen at work, so I need to keep my mind stimulated. I also want to recommend Fora, F-O-R-A.tv, which has a huge selection of videos, lectures, debates. Many of them have downloadable audio versions. Huge diversity of speakers and subject matter. I recommend Uncommon Knowledge from the Hoover Institution. Diversify people, so Fred Cole says. And I'll sort of just let that stand, except to agree very much that people should get a range of speakers to listen to. And I also want to say that the Spycast and the International Spy Museum, a year ago I had the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. and participate in the spy tour, and it was amazing. They're going to take you around D.C. and show you the places where the FBI and the CIA and the KGB all did their spy work and who defected and such. It's some really interesting history there, all while you're seeing the modern city of D.C. and not realizing that this block or that block was a drop-off point for the KGB. So really interesting stuff. Brett Miller writes, Bruce, your 9-20-09 podcast and Incredible Passages was great. As you state, one of the super big programs that we as Americans depend on and would fight to keep started out as a contentious, divisive issue. And all of the super big programs ended up being shaped by the demands of both ends of the political spectrum. While we know about the 20th century programs like Social Security and Medicare, your addition of civil service reform in the 1800s was incredibly illuminating. I never would have known that this triumphant that had you not brought it up. The idea that all civil service livelihoods in the public sector were subject to disruption with every new election because of a spoil system is unthinkable today. I see now why Chester Arthur is your mascot. Just to address, thank you, Brett, and just to address that point, very quickly on the Chet Arthur, my icon on the website is Chester Arthur, more for his obscurity than anything else. It's not so much hero worship of Arthur, but the fact that he is an obscure 19th century president, one sometimes referred to as the great bearded ones, the forgotten presidents, they're seen as not important. There was politics going on at that time in the Gilded Age that are the equivalent of today. It is perhaps true that it wasn't the imperial presidency. It wasn't that some of the consequences of the decision weren't as worldwide and far-reaching. But the politics were very similar, and we can learn a lot from examining the politics that somebody like a Chester Arthur or Rutherford B. Hayes or James Garfield for the short time was involved with. And yes, back then, basically any federal employee was subject to change with every election. So one of the most important reasons to gain the presidency was to get all of those executive appointed jobs. But it is not true that today all of that is gone. At the state and local level, there is still a heavy amount of patronage, although many states have adopted the type of civil service system that the federal government uses. And there are still jobs not covered by civil service, so there still are jobs that change with every administration. It's just that it has helped some employees get some protection over time, and it's helped the federal government to have some stability. I mean, if you have a good employee who's gaining experience, you want to keep them and not have them out every 4 years. Brett Miller also writes, when will the News Hour with Jim Lehrer start putting you on the historian paddle? Perhaps you need to have your podcast transcribed and edited into a book. Don't forget your footnotes like Goodwin did. Well, thanks, Brett, and I think I'll be keeping the podcast format for some time. I prefer it. I get to control the content. I see myself in a bit of a different role from a historian, per se. I'm more like a historic analyzer. I'll tend to use secondary materials. I'll read their books. I'll read Goodwin's book. I'll read McAuliffe's book. Occasionally, though, I do get into the primary sources, and that's interesting, but I don't have the type of study. Now, I'm not sure with somebody like a good... Doris Kearns Goodwin is how much of the actual research she's doing versus an assistant, and is she mostly the TV face? You know, I'm not sure. Damian Ober writes, heard Tony's question on the show about biographies of lesser-known presidents. Have to mention John Nevin's Martin Van Buren. And that is N-I-V-E-N, Martin Van Buren. Great. Great to learn about old Kinderhook. Want to thank you for listening. Website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. I'll always plug the archive. It's $9.99. That's a special price for the recession. We might be coming out of the recession, so we'll talk about that as we move along. But right now, it's $9.99. You'll get the archives of this program. You want to learn about tax cuts. You want to learn about the Secret Service. You want to learn about primary elections, conventions, how those started. You want to learn about Iowa and New Hampshire. You want to learn about midterms and the Speaker of the House. It's all there. MyHistoryCanBeatUpYourPolitics.com. Also, check us out on Facebook. Thank you for listening.